It's Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism, coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. My name's Olivia Rosenman. Joining me in the studio is BuzzFeed news reporter Gina Rushton. Hi, Gina.
Hi.
And the editorial director of Time Out, Alex Gorman.
Hi. Hi.
And joining us on the line from Melbourne is Matilda Dixon-Smith, staff writer with Junkie. Hi, Matilda.
Hi.
The University of Sydney Medical School last week announced a study into the impact of endometriosis on the sexual well-being of men. Endometriosis is a common condition that affects about 1 in 10 women and causes a range of symptoms including severe pain, especially around the time of ovulation, during sex and while urinating. There are currently a number of treatments to alleviate the symptoms, but there is no cure. Many women's health professionals agree that endometriosis is underdiagnosed, underreported and underresearched. After the study was announced last week, there was a swift and extremely negative response, both online and in an op-ed published in The Guardian, written by Imogen Dunleavy, who described the study as enraging. Dunleavy wrote, "Considering the tiny amount of attention and funding endometriosis gets, it's enraging to see someone conducting a study into how this disease impacts men." Dunleavy went on to say, "Studies like this one make it look like the only way endometriosis will get attention is if we highlight how it hurts men." A number of other publications, including the ABC, Channel 9 and Junkie, covered the study and the backlash. The researcher has defended her study and the call out for participants was shared and supported by a number of leading endometriosis organisations, including Endometriosis Australia and EndoActive, who posted on their Facebook page that in the current controversy over whether it's okay or not to research this topic, let it be known that we are fully in favour of it. Matilda, let me start with you. There's a valid point to be made here that endometriosis is a common condition that receives very little funding and hence focusing on the male experience of a disease that affects women is probably not a primary concern. But do you think this point could have been made with a little bit less outrage?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when we first came across the story in the office, a lot of us had that first reaction as well because, you know, we know people who suffer from this disease and we know that there's not a huge amount of support, particularly from the medical community, about it because there is so little that's still known. But it was only once I sort of looked into it and I spoke to a few people that I realised that while there is a point to be made about how much funding and how much research goes into it, there's no call to say that there shouldn't be this kind of research as well. And I think that was kind of the point that got slightly misconstrued.
Gina, let's talk about the op-ed in The Guardian. So it was an op-ed, but I'm just wondering if publishing criticism of scientific practice by someone who is not a scientist at all is a little bit dubious. What do you reckon?
That's a hard one, especially with when it comes to women's health, because I think with things like endo, you know, it's so misdiagnosed and so disregarded. And I think we all know someone who has it, who's been turned away from an emergency department with a handful of painkillers. So with health issues like this, I actually think personal stories are really important. So I don't know if it's so much as that it's not appropriate that she's criticising scientific research or whatever. I think that if it's an issue that's not being talked about and she's had a personal experience of it, I actually think that's okay.
Most of the articles that covered this whole controversy shared a link to another study that is also being carried out by the University of Sydney in collaboration with EndoActive that asked patients who have been medically diagnosed with endometriosis to share their experience in an online survey. Alex, is it okay for the media to arbitrate and direct traffic to studies in this way?
I think it's good for the media to act as a megaphone for studies, but I found the Guardian article pretty reckless because it completely misrepresented the processes that result in the funding of academic studies. This was a master's thesis study, so it wasn't funded. The fact that the article said it's enraging to see something like this taking place, this is a young female scientist's master's project that this woman was tearing down. And I think the total lack of insight into how funding is allocated, into where the issues lie when it comes to the misrepresentation and the lack of resource allocation and the misunderstanding of endo in the medical community, was really reckless. I agree that personal narratives are very important when it comes to these things. I think they help with ultimately getting better funding. They help tell GPs that this is something that they should be looking out for, but to conflate a master's study with the lack of representation of endo in the medical community and the lack of understanding with endo in the medical community was outrageous. Studies like this ultimately will hopefully help to make endometriosis a more prominent issue and a more prominent concern. We can study the way that childhood cancer affects the emotional well-being of parents. That doesn't mean we're not looking into curing childhood cancer as well. Mm. So I think there were a lot of false equivalencies drawn, and I think it was irresponsible of The Guardian to publish that article without fact-checking it.
Gina, you spoke about the need for personal stories around women's health issues especially to be shared. And you also shared a couple of days ago a story on Twitter about how men also experience grief and depression around abortion and how this is related to increased use of drugs and alcohol and suicide in men. Do you think that... how this is allegedly related. Do you think that we need to stop separating women's health issues and men's health issues, that that's not actually a helpful distinction to make?
It's a hard one when it comes to abortion because it's so politicized and it is so much about female bodily autonomy. So it's hard to treat abortion as just a health issue, even though I'm sure there's a lot of people that wish it was just treated as a health issue. In terms of separating it, look, I mean, probably for funding reasons and awareness reasons, it's probably not helpful to separate it, no.
That being said, biologically, it is important that we separate it to some extent. So I recently interviewed Jenny Valentish, who has just written a book called Woman of Substances about women and addiction. And one of the most shocking things in the book is that no addiction studies and no studies of detoxes are really conducted on women because women's hormonal cycles are viewed as messing with the data. So that means that if you're a woman who's going through a medically sanctioned detox for alcoholism or for drugs, you're working on unproven territory and your experience is going to be pretty wildly different because of the fluctuation in your hormones. So when it comes to separating them, I think right now in a lot of studies, men are considered the baseline and that is a big problem.
Matilda, how much of an impact do you think that public debates like this have on what is researched in science?
I think it's important for the public to have a voice. And I do think, you know, I agree that these personal stories are important. But I think at the end of the day, where I kind of came down on this particular issue is that we shouldn't be calling for something to not be funded or not to be researched, because at the end of the day, these research projects are all going to contribute and are all going to help. So while I think it's important for people to have a voice, I don't think that voice should necessarily dictate what we are and are not researching.
And we have to remember we're in a time where science funding in general is being slashed. So talking about kind of what's virtuous to fund and what's not virtuous to fund when across the board the ARC grants for research funding are being significantly reduced is like, it's a bit of context that should probably be added to any of these questions.
Yeah, I agree with you that it's a bit reckless to kind of go in there saying this sort of thing should not be funded or that this sort of research is enraging, because really we shouldn't be discouraging any funding towards scientific research projects.
And this one wasn't funded at all, or was minimally funded in the first place.
You're listening to For the State. Now, more controversy for our next topic. News Corp has said they will boycott a new appointment to the Australian Press Council. And in the past 5 days, there have been at least 6 articles published in The Australian. That was my latest count on why that person is not fit for the job. That person is Carla McGrath, the deputy chairwoman of the progressive political activist group GetUp. On announcing her appointment, the Press Council highlighted that McGrath is a Torres Strait Islander woman with a strong record of engagement in advocacy and said that the appointment reflected strong commitment to increased diversity and broad expertise in the council's rank. I think it's fair to describe the barrage of negative coverage by News Corp as a war, and it's certainly not the first time that News Corp has waged war on the Press Council. News Corp continuously criticised former Press Council chair Professor Julian Disney, who stepped down in 2015. On his way out the door, Disney condemned News Corp papers for their, quote, extravagant criticism of the Press Council's adjudications and processes. But News Corp is not the only organisation to voice concern over the appointment. The Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance has described Carla McGrath's position at GetUp as incompatible with her duties at the Press Council. Several prominent Australian journalists have denounced the appointment, and ABC's Media Watch also covered the issue on Monday in a piece of probably never-to-be-repeated television in which Paul Barry said that he agreed with Miranda Devine when she said that although Carla McGrath is well qualified, her role at GetUp disqualifies her from being an appropriate choice. Alex, do you think that Carla McGrath's role prevents her from being able to serve with impartiality as a Press Council member?
Well, I would question whether the MEAA is a politically impartial body too. So I think that News Corp are very good at picking their battles when it comes to who they're targeting, whether it's with the Australian Press Council, whether it's going after other young women of colour. I think if it was someone else, they probably wouldn't be hammering this anywhere near as hard. There are other members of the Australian Press Council who are politically active, who have had political involvements, and there are a lot of members of the Australian Press Council. So do I think that they are being particularly aggressive on this one for other reasons? Yes.
Miranda Devine, who writes for the Daily Telegraph, described GetUp, she was speaking on Sky News, she described GetUp as an extreme left-wing political activist group that is effectively the militant wing of Labor, the Greens and the union movement. Do you think that that's a fair and journalistically sound description of GetUp?
No, but I mean, that's the language they use. I think that any kind of valid interrogation of like the role between the media and political advocacy groups is just has just been totally eclipsed by the petulance of these campaigns, which News Corp are really good at. They're really good at it. I don't envy Carla at all, or anyone who's been the subject of any of their campaigns. And I think that language like that, it's almost, it's extreme, but it's almost kind of meaningless now. I think, I mean, I've heard those catchphrases like multiple times, and I think that no one really hears that for the first time and is like, oh, wow. You know, of course, that's what Miranda Devine says about GetUp.
You mentioned these News Corp campaigns, and in fact, David Salter wrote a piece in Crikey that described the Australian's coverage of this issue as another 18C-style campaign and said the paper was, quote, indulging in the same style of overkill that elevated Bill Leake to imagine martyrdom and painted Gillian Triggs as a she-devil.
The thing about News Corp's campaigns like this is that quite often people's baseline interaction with them isn't reading the full Miranda Devine piece. It's the cover art and it's the headlines only. So that hyperbole kind of seeps into your subconscious because you see it in newsstands, you see it sometimes on billboard ads, and it's the intensity and the ferocity with which they leverage their front covers that makes them so powerful.
Right. And while they have not yet been successful with 18C, I think it's probably fair to say that they inspired Gillian Triggs' political persecution. So, I mean, what's next if the Australian starts meddling with the operation of the Press Council? Is there much hope for the body's survival?
They've been messing with it for years.
Yeah. But they, I mean, they're really good at running campaigns. I mean, I think that they're pretty effective. Like, whether it, like, gets the outcome they want, they'll trash her credibility or the credibility of those adjudications. Yeah. Although, you know, the Press Council has said she's not going to be involved in any adjudications that where there is a conflict of interest. So it's kind of almost...
But I think so few people are going to see that part of it. It's,
yeah.
The issue is you can't unring a bell.
Yeah.
And they've rung that bell. And as you said, they're really good at ringing bells very hard.
Hmm.
So there'll always be that thing in the back of people's minds like, oh, I'm suspect of her.
Yeah.
So it has been over a week since the announcement of her appointment. And despite this relentless coverage or campaign, as we might describe it, the Press Council has not yet yielded to the pressure and reversed the appointment, and neither has McGrath resigned, despite them calling on her several times to do so. Perhaps I could ask each of you if you think that McGrath will go through and serve her term as a Press Council member.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's hard if you're somebody like McGrath not to feel like you're being a little bit persecuted when there are multiple articles being written about this and people are talking about it. But it's very difficult when you're getting into a conversation about impartiality and people serving on things like the Australian Press Council, because really nobody's impartial. And I think that's something that's a little bit of a fallacy to not acknowledge that other people who sit on that council might not have other political activity that might influence them. So I hope that she sticks by the appointment and doesn't resign, because then it does really call into question how we talk about impartiality in general.
What about you, Gina? Do you think she'll survive the campaign?
Yeah, I think she'll survive it.
I have hope that she does, but I think she could be a very valuable person for the Press Council, because arguably GetUp is one of the most successful publishers in the country, and they approach media and the way they approach communication is thought leading, it's industry leading, and I think the insights that she could provide into how to run a new media campaign and the ethics and issues that go along with that is something that could be of huge value, and it's something that old media doesn't necessarily always get.
It's a great observation.
Yeah.
You're listening to Fourth Estate. You're with me, Olivia Rosenman, and I'm speaking to Gina Rushton, Alex Gorman and Matilda Dixon-Smith. Triple J's current affairs program, Hack, is hosting a live TV debate on the topic, Is Male Privilege Bullshit? The promo says the debate will ask the question, does male privilege really exist? And if so, how does it impact us today? It's scheduled to broadcast on ABC2 on June 20th. But the debate has sparked intense debate and criticism. Writing in the SMH, journalist and commentator Ruby Hamad slammed Triple J, not only for suggesting that this was a question for which the answer had not yet been resolved, but also for following faulty logic that objectivity means giving equal airtime to both sides of an issue. Hamad wrote, quote, "Not every topic is up for debate. Just because there are vehement disagreements on certain issues, it does not automatically follow that each opposing viewpoint is equally valid, nor that the job of the journalist is to never take sides." Matilda, is it dangerous for journalists to insist on neutrality in controversial matters?
I absolutely think so. I mean, that this particular Hack controversy followed another one where Hack chose to speak to somebody who engages in this stealthing phenomenon, which is essentially could be considered a form of sexual assault, and they pretty much gave somebody unimpinged airtime to sort of advocate for his position to have sex with women in a certain way without their consent. And I think that,
but at the end of that conversation, he sounded like what he was.
Yes,
they gave
absolutely
him exactly enough rope to hang himself.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that I can see how that situation would kind of bolster them to continue to present themselves as a sort of impartial middle ground between two different opinions. But you know, as Ruby Hamad said excellently, not everything is a debate that stands on equal footing. Sometimes we don't need to hear two sides of a story. And she really brilliantly brought up the climate change argument and how much the media's reluctance to come down on a certain side has made people think that it is a debate, when in fact, you know, a century of scientists are saying that it isn't. And I think that that is a potential issue.
Do the many indicators that women are disadvantaged in society, I'm talking about indicators like the fact that women get paid less, are less represented in politics and in upper levels of management, are much more likely to be victims of rape and domestic violence, are less recognised in art and in the media, to name a few. Do you think indicators like that are enough to prove that male privilege is a thing?
Yes. In short, I mean, I think like the outrage over this, and it's exactly what Ruby's saying, there's not always a debate that needs to be had. But I think it's that kind of thing that I think every woman I know has found herself like at the pub trying to explain this to a man, that privilege doesn't discount suffering. Very privileged men can still suffer and feel pain. and have bad things happen to them and all of that. And the thing about it is like using a term like male privilege, you're speaking to an audience that is like woke or whatever, like, you know, versed in identity politics. And it's a phrase that you either know what it means and you're kind of aware of it, or you don't, in which case you think it's outrageous. And it's what hack does best. It's divisive. But I think it's kind of, to me, it was almost like it's the natural project for hack to do, because I think a lot of people I know, and I definitely think that you listen to hack and like someone will call up and say the most offensive bigoted thing and Tom Tilley will be like, interesting point. And like, that's kind of what this is, isn't it? Like, it's,
yeah, I mean, I've seen the Triple J text line and I think that this phrasing is very expertly crafted to talk to the Triple J audience, many of whom, and if you go on their Facebook, it's even worse, really would say something like that. I'd also like to add that my answer to the question is male privilege bullshit is also yes, because I hate the idea that we don't consider the way men are treated as the baseline for reasonableness. I think anything less than being treated like a white guy is oppression, and the language of privilege and the way that it's sunk into kind of woke speak as the way that we talk about these things is kind of damaging. I think saying, oh, it's a privilege, suggests that if women were equal, then men would have to give something up. And almost all of the time, that's just not true.
Yeah.
So coming at it from a perspective that's admittedly leftist, I also think male privilege, in scare quotes, is bullshit. But I think they've crafted this because they are speaking to an audience, probably more than half of whom would answer yes to the question, is male privilege bullshit, for all sorts of reasons. And I think, look, it would be nice if we lived in a world where this wasn't something that's kind of up for debate, but the reality is hack are reaching out to an audience that it is very difficult to reach. If you look at like the kind of insights stats on people who listen to and consume Triple J, that is the only media they are consuming, most of Triple J's listeners. So for their audience, I think it's an appropriate question to be asking, and we don't know how it's going to shake out. When we see the live debate, then we'll be able to judge. But I think that that provocative headline is expertly geared to an audience that only they are talking to.
Firstly, for the sake of our listeners who aren't familiar with the term woke speech, can one of you define that
for us?
I really
regret saying it, hey. Enlightened?
It means, I guess, awake to the realities of systematic oppression.
You are not sleeping through systematic oppression, yeah, because you are awake.
Right. In the 18th century, Marx might have called it class consciousness.
Yes.
Right, thanks for that. But let's also talk more about this term privilege, because it's something that we've seen in the media more and more in recent years. And in fact, it was first popularized in the 80s by a women's studies scholar in the US. But I think in the past few years, as I said, we've seen it increasingly to the extent that BuzzFeed even now has a check your privilege quiz.
But yeah, I wonder, lots of quizzes.
I mean, is the term itself problematic? Is it too heated now? Is it not helpful in these kind of discussions?
Should I think
we move
it's
away?
Insipid, not problematic. The issue with privilege is it's so weak, and I think it disguises the ugly reality. That's why I like the word oppression, because it refers so much more to what's going on. Are there people in the world with privilege? Yes, but they're a much smaller group than we'd like to think. And I actually think that privilege language kind of frames everything in terms of neoliberalism, where we're all fighting for crumbs at the bottom of the table.
Yeah, and oppression is more like speaking to a systematic reality, I guess.
I mean, I think, if I can just jump in, I agree with you that I think privilege is kind of the wrong word. And I think what it does, and ultimately I think what this question does, is kind of removes a lot of nuance from the conversation. And while I could give hack the benefit of the doubt in terms of perhaps the live debate or the live sort of discussion that they have around this question will turn out to be as nuanced as the one we're having here, my suspicion is that that's not actually, you know, what will happen. And I worry that just asking the question, does male privilege exist, against a background of the survey that they put up, which included the kind of questions that put men's rights activists up against feminists and this kind of thing, as if they stand on equal footing, is a little bit worrying, because I think what it does is kind of removes a little bit of nuance from this discussion about what privilege is and what oppression is. And so I guess that's kind of my issue with it.
But I guess, like, for this audience, which is this very specific audience, I don't know if they're at the point where having a super nuanced debate is possible, and better to talk about it than not. Hopefully it will introduce an increased level of complexity, and I think that Hack handles complexity pretty well. Full disclosure, I go on that show quite a lot. But
I guess that's a very good way of thinking about it. I think that the kind of negative aspect of that, some debate is better than no debate. Unfortunately, the reality of that isn't always true. I mean, some debate about climate change has ended up meaning that we still ask world leaders whether or not they believe in climate change, which is a ridiculous question. That's not something that you can or cannot believe in. It's a scientific fact. And that's because we had a debate around climate change. So while I guess that sometimes that argument of some debate is better than no debate at all is a great argument to make, I'm not sure I fully believe in it. But I think
it's a really well-phrased question in another way, though, because if you kind of look at the syntax of it, the question could be, is male privilege bullshit? Like, yeah, it is bullshit. It's bullshit that men have privilege. So I think, like, there is a double meaning here as well. That
yeah.
I was going to ask you guys all if you have any tips for the affirmative side of the debate, and I think that's a great one, Alex. Gina or Matilda, do you have any tips that you'd give to the affirmative side of that argument?
No.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I really liked the comment that privilege is the wrong word, because the better thing to focus on is oppression. And I think the thing I don't like about talking about privilege is that it frames it from the top rather than the bottom, which is where the debate's a little bit problematic, because what we're doing is focusing on the people who might have privilege as opposed to the people who have oppression, which is where the conversation could potentially be focused. But
and it suggests that the systems of oppression around women are something that doesn't hurt men as well. Like, men also have nothing to lose but their shackles in this one. So, yeah, they're being dragged down too.
I absolutely agree with that.
All right, well, Tom Tilley, if you're listening, I think there's some pretty sage advice there to take into the moderation of that debate. Now, unfortunately, that is all we have time for on Fourth Estate. Thank you so much to my guests, Gina Rushton. Thank you.
Thanks.
Alex Gorman, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
And Matilda Dixon-Smith, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Please do stay in touch with us on Facebook and on Twitter. We are always interested to hear what topics you'd like us to cover. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast. And if you're already a subscriber, please leave us a review on iTunes. I'm still sending stickers to people who leave us a review. Mitchell, I hope you've received yours. Graham, yours is in the mail. And Isabel C., we are still waiting for your address. Thank you for tuning in. We will catch you at the same time next week.